Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We are live from the Miami Book Fair. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening today. Dave Barry is with us, Miami Herald columnist. His latest book, Best State Ever, A Florida Man Defends His Homeland. Craig Pittman is a longtime environmental journalist with the Tampa Bay Times. His book, Oh, Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Maria Carla Chiquin, also here. She has written Achieve the College Dream. You don't need to be rich to attend a top school. She came to Miami from Cuba as a teenager and went on to graduate from Harvard and the London School of Economics. And Bruce Turkel here as well, a longtime Miami native and branding expert, author of All About Them, Grow Your Business by Focusing on Others. Live from the book fair here and online and, of course, on the telephone, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We are live from the book fair, still taking your phone calls. And let's begin, Dave Barry, with you. With this election over, you called this a choice between ointment and a suppository. So which one won?
I'm revealing my bias here. I'm going with suppository. But it wasn't a happy choice. I did a lot of traveling in the fall. I was on a book tour. And the country wasn't really excited about this election. I mean, I'm not saying everybody. I'm just saying there was just sort of this general mood of, this is it. This is our choices. I heard a joke. Can I tell this joke?
If it's clean, tell it.
I heard this joke. Hillary Clinton, this is during the election. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are riding in an airplane. And Donald Trump says, I'm going to throw a $100 bill out and make out the window, make somebody down there really happy. And Hillary Clinton says, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to throw 10 $10 bills out there and make 10 people really happy. And the pilot says, I'm going to throw you both out and make everybody happy. So that's I kind of think that's sort of summarized the mood.
Craig, what is America's weirdest state? What's the influence going to be on the Trump administration now?
Well, obviously, I mean, since he lives here part-time, he is a part-time Florida man. Yeah. Florida has never elected a full-time Florida man to the White House.
Can he be considered the first Florida president?
He comes pretty closer than anybody else. In the past, we've had more luck causing problems for presidents.
Right.
You know, the Watergate burglars came from here. Someone involved in the Lincoln assassination conversation came from Florida, bungled his assignment, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Didn't they try to assassinate Roosevelt here?
Yes, there was an attempt to assassinate Roosevelt here. The guy missed, of course.
Right.
It'll be interesting. And, of course, Mr. Trump has expressed a preference for not living in the White House. So I suspect he'll be spending at least part of his administration in Mar-a-Lago.
He's not going to live in the White House at all?
He doesn't want to live in the White House.
He has said.
So, like, it's vacant? Could we make an offer?
Maybe we could rent it out and make some money off
of it.
Could
be a piece of prime real estate in Washington, D.C.
Exactly. I think he'll be living in Florida part-time while he's doing whatever it is he's going to do. And, you know, of course, continuing to fight with his neighbors, which is a very Florida
And the Palm Beach International Airport as
well. Although I think he dropped his lawsuit against them over the airplanes.
And he's been litigious in the past to drop and then bring them back, too.
This is true. And now he can call it an airstrike.
Bruce, how about it? Make America Great was the winning theme in all of this. So how do we process it here 10 days out?
It was actually Make America Great Again.
Right.
That was the idea, that for the people who he wanted to support him, the people who felt disenfranchised, they were going to go back to this fantasy view of what used to be here. Whether it was or wasn't is irrelevant. Whether he could do it or not was irrelevant. He clearly described exactly what he was going to do for them. And they repaid him at the polls.
What does that mean, Phil, for Florida? I mean, Florida, obviously, you know, Dave is if Florida is going to be made great again, describe the great Florida of years past.
Well, there were a lot more alligator wrestlers down here. I don't know.
And fewer pythons, maybe, right?
Yeah. Yes, far fewer pythons. If you can get rid of the pythons, I think we consider the administration a success.
Okay.
From the Florida standpoint, yes.
Well, yeah, we were discussing this earlier. The pythons are winning the python challenge. We need to challenge an animal we can defeat. Manatees would be my suggestion.
Manatees, maybe tegu lizards could be next, perhaps.
Yeah, or panthers, yes. Not as many as them.
Yeah, the automobiles are winning on the panther challenge, yeah.
Or Jets fans. You know, we can expand the...
You realize you asked that question to two guys who write books about why Florida was not great.
That's right.
Shouldn't expect any other kind of
Dave,
answer.
Dave made the argument it's the best state ever.
Now, wait a minute. I think, Dave says it's the best state ever. I say it's the most interesting state in the union.
Interesting is a euphemism.
Well,
always.
As in, you know, the most interesting man in the world. By rights, we should have our own beer commercials.
Yeah, here's a proud statistic. This is a, can you back me up on this, Greg?
Yes. They're making it up, right?
They're getting
Florida,
it up.
Florida has 6% of the nation's population and produces 57% of the nation's weirdness.
Oh,
isn't that right?
Oh, at least 57%.
80% of all statistics and are made up on the spot.
That's right. And I think the variable in there is about 90%.
Yeah, so give or take.
Let me bring Maria in here. We're going to have to represent your generation here, Maria, for the millennial vote, especially the millennial Florida vote. Where was it in this election? It was certainly in the campaign, and we've seen it on the streets of Miami and the streets elsewhere after the election, but didn't necessarily show up at the voting booth. Why not, do you think?
I think we need to get off the couches. I think we are a very engaged generation online, but we just have to realize that we have to get our voices out offline as well. You know, there were a lot of undecideds who came out in the end. I don't know exactly what the stats are in terms of, you know, which percentage of those undecideds were millennials. But we are definitely an online generation, and we need to do a lot more to get out there and be engaged, get to know our representatives. I think there is a lot of new local media, like, for example, the Nootropic here in the community is doing a great job in bringing millennials out into offline events, building community. But there's a lot more that we can do in the sense integrating our very vibrant active dialogue online with actually engaging with other generations too. I think we sometimes fall, we trap ourselves in a millennial bubble, and it's important that we're engaging in wider conversations if we really want to have our voices you know, heard where it counts.
Dave, you talk across generations. You acknowledge not being too far away from bathroom humor frequently and trying to stay true to that.
My core demographic.
That's right. That's right. You're on your way to talk to some sixth graders after this program,
those
as a matter
people.
Of fact,
yeah.
Which will obviously be a higher intellectual conversation than we're having right now on the Florida Roundup. But how do you break through that bubble? I mean, you know, we saw this being a very digital campaign on the part of the Democrats, and for Trump, it was in person and tactile.
Yeah, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and I am continually amazed at how her existence is almost entirely in the ether. I mean, she, you know, the old joke that they're like, they're two of them and they're in the same car and they're communicating by texting. That's a real thing. That I've witnessed that. I drive a carpool full of 16-year-old soccer playing girl. And that's how they communicate with everybody in the world, including the people they're sitting next to. I don't know how you break out of it. They're really good at it. my daughter's friends with everybody in Dade County.
But you with your approval?
I don't know. You know, right. I was like, who is that person? That's somebody I know. How do you know? You know, how do you know that person?
I'm hanging out with my friends. You're alone in your room. That's what I tell my 11-year-old. He says, no, I'm hanging out with my friends.
For what it's worth, I have an 18-year-old. This was his first election to vote in, and I had to tell him at one point, unfortunately, not every presidential race is nearly this interesting. So don't get your hopes up for next time.
But this, what happened is not new. FDR won because he understood the media of the time, which was radio. He did his fireside chats. We all know about Kennedy beating Nixon because he looked better on television. The folks who listened said Nixon won the debate, but the folks who watched voted for Kennedy. Obama understood how to use the internet for fundraising and to get the message out. Trump understood the newest media, which at the time was Twitter. And because he understood how to reach people that way, probably like your son and your daughter who were on it 24/7 on social media, and he knew how to communicate because of his lifetime or his at least 15 years as a reality TV star, he dominated that media. So yes, the Democrats used digital media very technically, but Trump used it in a way that spoke to people's hearts.
Also, I just want to point out that my daughter views Instagram, no, not Instagram, Twitter and Facebook is like a really old person thing.
You know, but she doesn't vote
how are you communicating? She always names some
Snap.
Yeah, or whatever, but it's something I never heard of and should have bought stock in.
And
honestly,
you don't want to, and you don't want to see what else is on it, by the way.
But here we are, though, you know, trying to form a new administration, Craig, and the president-elect is not holding press conferences every day to update the American public or the American press about the progress toward a transition team to take over the White House and take over the federal government. He's not releasing statements daily. He's tweeting.
He's tweeting. Yes.
That's what he's doing.
Yes.
What's the takeaway? What can we expect from the administration if we're still seeing, you know, tweets from the president-elect here?
I think we have to watch his Twitter very closely, obviously.
Sure.
You know, and the interesting, what was more interesting was that he ducked out on his press pool to go to a steakhouse.
Right.
And then it caused this huge uproar. He's used to living in sort of a bubble, you know, where he gets up in the morning, he takes an elevator to his office, he works in the office, he goes back down in the elevator to his home. And the only other times he's out, he's either in one of his own limos or one of his own jets or helicopters. And so now he's going to have to be out of that. The if he thought the scrutiny that he got during the election was intense, it's going to be even more so now. And so, you know, he's going to have to change some of the things that he does. I saw yesterday that I guess people in England were horrified that he was on the phone with the Prime Minister, I believe, and said, you know, if you come to America, just, you know, look me up.
The Prime Minister of Australia. In fact, the story was the Prime Minister of Australia wanted to call the President-elect to congratulate him. He had to get the President-elect's cell phone number from Greg Norman.
Yes. Yes. It's a new world.
Apparently they're calling Trump Tower and getting the receptionist. Can you imagine? Like, Prime Minister of what? Who? You know? Do you have an appointment?
Are you on the list?
Again, there is, though, once again, there's a bigger picture here. If you look at what's happening in the world, Airbnb disintermediated the hotel companies with technology. Uber has disintermediated the taxi companies. Amazon has done it to retailers. What Trump is doing is disintermediating the fourth estate. He can now talk directly to his, you used the word bubble before, he can talk to his bubble, he can talk to his consumers, his voters. Like it, dislike it is irrelevant. He now has that power. And we've seen what it's done to companies, this disintermediation, like Kodak and like the hotel companies. Well, watch, that's what's going to happen to what we consider the responsible media.
This is the Florida Roundup live from the Miami Book Fair. Still taking your phone calls at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We'll let folks know here with us in Building 8 on Miami-Dade College's campus in downtown Miami. If you have a question, we've got a microphone for you. Maria, I want to put this to you as the representative of the millennial generation, the youngest potential voter up here. As we're talking about these new eras of communication, a lot's been talked about in the last week or so about the role of fake news on social media, and the role that Facebook as a distribution platform plays in sussing out that fake news. As you go about your media diet, you are a highly educated millennial who's fully engaged with higher education here at the college and elsewhere. What are the guidelines? How is the appetite and the discernment on the part of the younger voter when it comes to figuring out what's true and what's not true and being able to question sources and question everything, to borrow a phrase from two generations ago?
I think on the one hand, we are a generation that tends to question everything, but that clashes with our instincts for immediate gratification and instant likes. I think we're so used to consuming media information so fast and sharing it so fast. I think it's time to pause, and this election should be a good opportunity to reflect and say, okay, where do we go from here? I think we need to reevaluate our behavior online and say, okay, are we really questioning are we really just falling trap of other people's news sites? I'm so glad to see that there is concern on the part of social media giants like Facebook and Twitter and even the current government over fake news, because it's been demonstrated that they might have decided the behavior of a lot of the voters. In the end, the articles that were getting the most shares and the most likes in the weeks leading up to the election were actually fake.
Turned out to be true, right?
Yeah, were actually
not true.
Fake. Now, some of the authors who were sort of taking it as a game, or they had another agenda with the fake news articles that they wrote. Now they're coming out and apologizing publicly because they realize it could actually have helped the opposite turnout that they were hoping for.
And what we've seen is sometimes that agenda is not so much partisan or political; it's an agenda just to prove that they can do it.
To get clicks.
To get clicks.
And clicks, exactly.
And to derive revenue from that. I think what we should do is we should set up a system where Dave gets to vet these things before they're posted.
I was going to say, I have been writing fake news for 30
exactly.
years, my entire
right.
career.
Exactly.
It's based upon
and,
fake
and
news.
Let's not knock fake news, people. Let's put my daughter through college is going to be fake
he's
news.
He's got this patented phrase of, I am not making this up. And I think if we were to put that as like the seal of approval on everything before it gets posted.
There you go.
I think that would be a tremendous benefit.
Let the revolution start here, Pittman. Let the revolution start here. We've got a question here with our audience at Miami Book Fair. Hi, how are you? What's your name?
Hi, thank you. Raquel Reyes. My question is kind of a lead off of that. That was a really good segue. You didn't know it, but thanks. So it seems like Trump has been normalized quite a bit. I mean, instantly overnight. And there's not a lot of pushback from media who is doing a lot of guilty head shaking that they were part of the fake news and, oh my goodness, blah, 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 but then yet they've normalized it. So coming to you all who have such great senses of humor and use comedy, what is comedy's role? I mean, because comedy could either help normalize it or it really could be satirical and pointed. And so what are you seeing and what do you forecast is going to be done with that? Because, you know, if the popular vote said no to him, then why is normalization happening and what is comedy going to do in regard to that?
Great question. I'll put it to the humorist at the other end of the table here, Mr. Dave Barry, who's going to represent all comedy for us.
Thank you. Well, part of the normalization, I think, is that he got elected. I mean, he didn't get win the popular vote, but he won the election, and he won according to the rules that we've had in this country for a long, long time. And it's, you know, I don't think that the New York Times can say he didn't get elected because he did. And we're going to all have to accept that. As for the role of comedy, I think it's going to be a golden age. It's like, and I hear what you're saying, that if, you know, it can be gentle or it can be mocking, but my instinct is it's going to be pretty harsh because he's not popular with the media, and I mean, that's not a secret, and I don't think he's popular with the entertainment world. I think the real danger, and maybe this is going to rankle you, but I think it's true, is that if we look too vicious and unfair, it will just reinforce the views of the many, many people. And there are a lot of people who voted for the guy and who don't like being all categorized as racist, homophobes, misogynist, whatever. I'm not saying that that component doesn't exist. But I know some Trump voters, and they don't fall into that category. I have my disagreements with them, but they don't like that and will not help if they're demonized. It will just reinforce, you know, the normalization you're so worried about, I think.
We're going to take a call here in a moment, but I want to put this to the rest of the panel, Craig, Bruce, and Maria. To this point, maybe not finding humor, but maybe even finding information in all of this, and to Raquel's point, this normalization. I mean, we've seen Steve Bannon, for instance, that's been appointed the chief strategist of the president-elect. He was the architect of the campaign in the final months, running what some would call an alt-right website, others would call a white nationalist website. Language matters in all this, to the point of the questioner in terms of normalization. Bruce, it's messaging, too. Words matter in all of this. And if we call something racist or race-baiting, if we call certain policies about extreme vetting that are really ethnically focused, I mean, how is the media and the importance that the media is going to put on the language that it selects communicating that to the broader audience in the years ahead?
The important thing, as I see it, is to try to figure out and understand what's at stake and what the communicators are not trying to communicate, but what they're trying to accomplish. So during the campaign, we all know what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to get their voters to actually get up off the couch and go vote. The question was, we knew that Trump was exciting his audiences. He had rallies where people were getting very, very excited. Some were getting violent. But what the general belief was, it's easy to get people to rallies. It's hard to get them to vote. And then the thoughts were the numbers don't work for him because those people don't vote, whether they're the people Dave talked about who are considered the bigots and the homophobes and the misogynists or other folks who had economic reasons to want to vote for him or whatever. The belief was they didn't vote. So the question was, will enough of them go out and vote? And the answer we found out was yes. As the Electoral College sees it, enough of them went out to vote.
I just want to make one point about the language matters thing. I find it disturbing to just automatically use the word racist. You know, when what you really mean is I don't like you or I disagree with you. If you're not pointing to a specific racist act, it sort of diminishes the meaning of that word. And I think that, you know, that there's a big danger with Trump, especially, to just sort of say that.
I disagree with you. I think
well, let's
the
talk
code
about this
works
real quick.
To go to words.
A policy, for instance, stop and frisk, where the president has talked about using that nationally, and that has been deemed very racial.
Those
very
are
racist.
Clear code words that say to people who pay attention, it doesn't say we stop and frisk everybody.
Okay,
a white guy with a suit and a BMW does not get stopped and
frisked. The point I'm making is we've spent the last, I don't know, 6 months telling everybody that Donald Trump's a racist. And it seems to me that now that he's actually won, to just keep that up is not
good.
But
I don't agree
with you. It didn't
work
the first time.
I don't know that he's a racist. What I know is that he uses racist terminology. Remember, I said it's about intention to accomplish what he wants. I don't think he's an ideologue. Truth is, I don't think he cares one way or the other.
Okay, I kind of agree with you. I guess we're saying the same thing. I'm just saying that I prefer that, though, you know, a word like that be aimed at a specific, as you say, stop and frisk, some specific thing that you can identify and say that's racist, rather than just sort of continually dismiss everyone you don't agree with as racist.
No, he is using racist tropes to accomplish what he wants, what his intention is.
But
whether
I think,
or not that
Maria,
makes
you've got some thoughts here.
I think regardless of the intention, it's important to know that words do matter in the sense that they attract or alienate a specific kind of group. All of my Facebook friends, pretty much I think 90% of them, are following the same media outlets. So whenever they see language or, you know, general discourse they don't agree with, that doesn't resonate with them, they automatically shut it down because, you know, there's so much other information that they can access. I think going back to comedy, for example, there is I agree that there is a golden opportunity now for a much bigger role in the sense of it becoming a neutralizer or more objective. What we've seen in this election especially is we have two polar opposites in the media. They're so hyper-partisan or hyper following one extreme ideology over the other, that it's hard to find, you know, media that can actually serve as a common ground for people. So comedy could open the doors to that, you know, neutral ground that could serve to gain more information as opposed to just reaffirm, you know, what our beliefs are getting you have from home or from your own, you know, very closed network circle of friends.
Let's take a quick phone call here. I'll have Craig and Dave put your headsets on so you can hear Paul. Paul is calling us from Plantation. Paul, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Just change the comment that I was going to make, because now that you're focusing on comedy, based on the what I self-selected to be the comedian, they got to a point in the election where they almost stopped making jokes about Donald Trump. And they just kind of called it as they saw it, because it stopped being so funny. So I understand that comedy could be a way to heal, but at some point, don't you just have to have an honest discussion about policy and call things what they are?
Do you think, Paul, that the media failed in that regard, to call things what they are, or was it just the comedians in the final weeks that took a more serious tone?
I think based on the mainstream media, the CNNs, the ABCs, et cetera, they tried to show a fair and level balance on things that aren't fair and level. So, yes, I do think they failed.
Yeah, Craig, to that final point there that the caller makes, Paul, thank you for the phone call. This leveling out, this equivalency that the media continues to try, that is baked into our DNA as journalists to get all sides of the story and treat them fairly. Can that be accomplished from what we just experienced and as we look forward to the next 4 years in the Trump administration? And if past is any precedence to the future, it's troubled relationship with facts and the truth.
There's a whole lot of stuff packed into that one question. So let me try and
unpack
it apart
it
a little
me.
Bit. Number one, I think in that TV found Trump so entertaining that he got an awful lot of free publicity from that Hillary Clinton did not get. And so I think that unbalanced the equivalence right off the bat. Second, I do think that there was a tremendous effort to unearth things about Mr. Trump's background, his taxes, his business practices, his bankruptcies, Trump University, et cetera, specifically by the press. And that effort was focused on trying to unearth things that he was trying to cover up or hide or say didn't matter. And so I don't think there was a problem with equivalence there either. Obviously, Clinton's email problems dominated a lot of her campaign, and the press was there on that as well. But I did not see TV, I think, treated those as if they were equal, but I don't think the press, the printed press, Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, treated those as if they were the same thing. Now, going forward, there's nobody rivaling Mr. Trump. He's in the spotlight alone, and so he will have to bear its entire focus. And so there's no need for equivalence anymore, and no need to be fair to somebody else. It's all about him, and he's probably not going to like the scrutiny he's going to get from here on in, and he'll probably complain about it, as indeed he's already begun complaining about it, and claiming that the New York Times lost subscribers when, in fact, they gained a tremendous number of subscribers.
41,000, right.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, in a way, he's single-handedly saving journalism, and we should all be grateful.
Greg Pittman is an environmental journalist, Tampa Bay Times, the new book, Oh, Florida. Maria Carla Chiquin is also along with us, Achieve the College Dream, and Bruce Turkel is here, all about them. Dave Barry, Miami Herald columnist, Best State Ever is his latest book. Dave, I know you got to get to those sixth graders here, so we'll bid you adieu. Thank you for joining us on the Florida Roundup.
That is my pleasure. Thank you.
We've got plenty more to come on our program. Stick with us. Immigration, education, Florida in the age of Trump, all coming up as the Florida Roundup for the Miami Book Fair continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here live today from the Miami Book Fair in Miami-Dade College in downtown Miami. There we go. It's Tom Hudson along with you. Thanks again for listening this week. Craig Pittman, the author of Oh, Florida, longtime environmental journalist for the Tampa Bay Times, is here at the Book Fair. Maria Carla Chiquin is the author of Achieve the College Dream, and Bruce Turkel also with us, all about them. You can join the conversation, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. A bit of a literary take on the election and what's ahead for the Florida community. 800-743-9576. Let's go to line three. Steve is with us from West Palm Beach, who's got a bit of a historical reminder. Steve, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Thank you. You know, it's funny. It just sort of reminded me of what I was witnessing in the L.A. riots in 92 after the Rodney King verdict. I mean, there are a lot of genuinely understandable grievances and concerns in that community, but they proceeded to go out and essentially destroy their own neighborhood in response. And I can understand a lot of people who voted for Trump because of issues in their lives that were understandable and truly need to be relieved or reconciled. But did Trump provide a response or the kind of detail that gave them any reason to believe that those issues would be resolved? I'll take my answer off the air.
Steve, I appreciate it. I will just one point of clarification. You're talking about the 1992 riots that were triggered after the Rodney King, the police verdict, where the police officers who beat Rodney King were found innocent, not guilty of the charges. Clearly, that was a much more significant riot compared to just the demonstrations that we're seeing around the country this time around. We're not seeing the real civic disobedience and the violence and the property damage at all compared to 1992. So I think a little bit of a, to borrow a phrase from this past election, of false equivalency there. That said, Craig Pittman, the word from the Trump administration, or the word from the campaigner Trump, was, what do you have to lose? That was a message he delivered here in Miami to the Cuban community. It was the message that he delivered to the Haitian community. It was the message that he delivered to the black community in the Gulf Coast and the Tampa Bay area.
Right.
What do you have got to lose? And the voters seemed, 30% of them in the black community voted for Trump nationwide, according to the exit poll. We had almost half of Cuban-American votes go for Trump here in the state of Florida. What's the takeaway from this?
I think a lot of people are looking for change. That was a big thing that helped Obama get elected. He was promising hope and change. And in a way, Trump was promising the same thing. And I think that resonated with a lot of people who, even though the economy in general has grown and done better, their lives and their personal situation has not. And so even some people who voted for Obama twice voted for Trump this time because they said, you know, it's like throwing the dice one more time and saying, well, okay, maybe this time I'll get the change that I want. I have to repeat a Dave Chappelle joke from Saturday Night Live where he was talking about the unrest that has occurred since the election, and he said, you know, they reported $1 million worth of damage, and he said, and black people looked at that and said, amateurs.
That's it.
So,
right.
But it's a sign of, I think, how bitterly divided America is that this is going on, that we're having this, that we had basically a split decision on the election, you know, popular vote versus electoral vote, and now we're having these massive demonstrations in cities around the country. And I just don't see how either candidate could unify the country that is so bitterly split the way it is.
Maria, let me ask you to talk about the experience from the Cuban American perspective. You came to the United States, came to Miami as a teenager from Cuba. You have gone through school. You graduated from Harvard, went to the London School of Economics. You're back in South Florida, applying that knowledge, applying those skills here locally. How do you make sense as a Cuban American as you look at the Cuban American vote, as a significant portion of it went to Donald Trump, and that means that a significant portion of it from South Florida went to Donald Trump?
You know, Tom, I think in general, not even just within the Cuban-American community or even just within millennials, there's a real need for inspiration in the country. And I think in this case, perhaps the candidate who won was not necessarily the most prepared, but the most inspiring to a particular group of core voters. And as millennials, we really feel the need to identify. I think that was that the inspiring messaging that Obama maintained throughout his candidacy was so so strong to bring millennials out into the vote. For this particular election, what we've seen is I think from a personal point of view, Americans in general, I don't think we were ever, even if we agreed more with Hillary's policies than with Trump policies, I think a lot of us, or a lot of Cuban Americans and Americans in general, felt more inspired or not by Trump or not inspired enough by Hillary to make that decision to leave the couch.
Craig?
Something else I should have mentioned before, and that is Trump attracted an almost baffling amount of support from evangelicals, who, of course, are very strong in both the black and the Cuban
right.
community. In spite of the fact that Hillary Clinton, longtime Methodist, big supporter of the Methodist creed, says she models her life on that, nevertheless, and Clinton and Trump, meanwhile, is a guy who had trouble naming any books of the Bible or any verses that he likes. But evangelicals see him as their only chance to hang on to the U.S. Supreme Court and to try to overturn Roe
right.
versus Wade. So I think that accounts for a certain number of those votes as well as that evangelical aspect.
I do want to mention a lot of the Cuban Americans who immigrated, recently more for economic than political reasons.
Sure.
My generation included. A lot of us are not able to vote yet because we are not citizens. So even though we would be more supportive of policies for engagement with Cuba, more of the continuation of policies that the Obama administration began to advance, unfortunately, a lot of those voices could not be heard, at the ballots. So that definitely hurt.
Bruce Kirkell, you are a South Florida native. This is a immigrant community in South Florida. It's an immigrant community that you grew up in. What's the message of this? It's a community, obviously, that voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Rodham Clinton in terms of the voter outcome in Miami-Dade County, Broward, and Palm Beach County. But the state of Florida went red and the country went red. So what's the message for the immigrant population that's been so important for the fabric of this community here in South Florida, your hometown?
Well, you know that they say that the two man-made items you can see from space are the Great Wall of China and the Dade-Broward line.
Right.
We could go a little further. You could include Broward and Palm Beach County, but South Florida is not actually part of Florida as far as voting goes.
Geographically, it is.
Geographically, yeah, sure. We are, but we are consistently and powerfully blue south of West Palm, and we are statistically and traditionally and powerfully red, other than the I-4 corridor and Gainesville and Tallahassee, where you have colleges, north of South Florida. So I don't think there's any particular consequence if you look at Florida as a state as a whole, because it's never been looked at that way before, as far as it being homogeneous or having one viewpoint or one vote. I think the problem we all make is when we tend to think that cause and consequence are related. What the caller from Palm Beach said, I think if you look at metaphorically, he was talking about the riots in California, people destroying their community, right, wrong, or otherwise. That's what he said. And I think in his opinion, he was saying Trump voters are destroying their own community, right? But I don't think there's a direct correlation, because I don't think you can say that people understand what Trump's going to do since he never said so.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look in England, where they had the Brexit vote, which should have been a harbinger of what was going to happen, they now have what are called the Brexiters, the people who said, oh, yeah, I voted for it to make a statement, but, oh, my goodness, I didn't mean to. I think there's a lot of that going on. The problem is we think one thing leads to the other. And by the way, Obama took big advantage of that with Yes, We Can. Yes was positive, We was inclusive, and Can was aspirational. I think it was probably the third best ad line ever written, because as we talked about earlier, 67% of new voters voted for him. And you can't tell me that new voters understood the issues.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing, we just saw it happen. We kid ourselves if we're on university campuses or we work for the press or we're writers. We kid ourselves if we think the majority of voters think consequence from cause as a linear thing. It's not. People buy with emotion and they justify with fact, not the other way around.
800-743-WLRN, the telephone number. It is the Florida Roundup live from the Miami Book Fair here today. Let's go to line four. Renee is on the telephone from Miami Lakes. Renee on line four, welcome to the program, to the Florida Roundup. Thank go
you.
Ahead.
Thank you, Tom. I want to discuss two items here. I think it's your guest, Maria, correct?
Yes.
Mentioned the fact that Trump might have not been prepared. Well, I think the Wharton School of Business should be kind of ashamed of themselves in outputting, if you will, graduating someone that speaks at a third grade level with huge words or great words, wonderful words. It's just mind-boggling. But this goes to show, in my opinion, the divide currently. What has occurred or has been divided for such a long time, such a division economically, maybe socially, economically, with education also, where we're...
Renee, the phone line's a little weak. Go ahead and get to your question, sir. Appreciate it.
All right, so my question is, are we at the point where we could be seeing a large divide between those who have and have not within the U.S.?
A larger divide, larger economic divide. Well, you know, we've got one of the largest economic divides locally here in Miami, Maria, that we've seen. A community, again, that you grew up in and you've come back to. It's one of the widest economic disparities in the United States, and we've seen wide economic disparities nationwide. Did you hear anything in the campaign that leads you to believe that those disparities are going to be closed or at least come back together in the next 4 years?
But I think that's probably, that's not a framework that I would identify with. And I think a lot of my friends as millennials, we're still not ready to think of the have and have nots and vote along the lines of who's going to provide more for me individually versus others. I am really inspired by you could call it more idealistic, but certainly the more universal discourse that I hear among my friends, among my generations, rather than, older generations within family circles and in the media at large. And I think that's probably one of the largest gaps that I have noticed throughout. Why do we have to think about whether this candidate will bring me personally only more, closer to the haves than the have-nots? What about the rest of the world? I think we really have to, even though that sounds very millennial, I think it's really the time to start, thinking more seriously about, the world really beyond us.
The all about me politics. That leads to our next segment here. We're going to talk more about messaging and slogans. Get your phone calls in, 800-743-WLRN. We're going to take a break here on the Florida Roundup. We'll talk about trying to decipher some of the double speak of politics and what we could hear in the next 4 years. The Florida Roundup live from the Miami Book Fair will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. We're back on the Florida Roundup today, live from the Miami Book Fair at Miami-Dade College. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Craig Pittman is along with us, a longtime environmental reporter with the Tampa Bay Times, author of Oh, Florida. Maria Carla Chiquin has written a book, Achieve the College Dream. She's along with us as well, as is Bruce Turkel, All About Them. Bruce, it's dangerous to boil the 16-month campaign down to slogans, but I want to do that for you with your professional focus and personal focus on branding. The first sentence of your book reads, quote, great salesmanship is about those you wish to lead, influence, and sell. So what is it about Trump voters, those that bought his message?
Well, I think you said the right word. Purchasing, if you're a consumer, is the same as voting when you're in the ballot booth. It's a limited resource. Other voters have unlimited resources dollar-wise, and you get to use it once, and you have to make a decision that you're going to live with for a long time, just like purchasing a product or purchasing a service. You said at the beginning that it's difficult or perhaps it's too simplistic to reduce 16 months of campaigning into a tagline, but think back to Eisenhower or Tyler. The only thing you remember, I Like Ike, Tippi Canoe, and Tyler too. In fact, that does become the way we remember mm-hmm. a lot of this. And as we said earlier, what Obama did with Hope and Change and Yes, We Can, versus when John McCain said, I am a maverick, which was kind of bizarre for a war hero to compare himself to a crappy Ford sedan, right? So I think, in fact, people are going to remember Make America Great Again, and they are going to remember Stronger Together. Think about it. Make America Great Again, again, whether you like or not. We're taking our partisan hats off here, but it said something to a consumer Trump wanted to reach, whereas Stronger Together, yeah, we all talk about the fact that the country is divided. There's haves and have-nots. There's red and blue. There's right and left. But honestly, most people who are separated like that don't actually want to come together. John Stewart said, if so, the middle would hold signs that say, let's just get along, right? There's no margin in the middle.
The Trump slogans went beyond just Make America Great Again, and they were divisive. It was build that wall. It was lock her up. It was extreme vetting. It wasn't this message of stronger together that you heard.
There was
the
no
side.
Stronger together that he wanted.
No.
What his audience wants is a re-ascendancy. They feel like their world has been taken away from them, and they want it back. And whether it was economic, whether it was social, whether it was religious, whether it was geographic, all of the things that a lot of us see as great freedoms for groups that have been underserved and certainly under-honored in our community came in some people's minds at the expense of others. They say when you're superior, equality looks like tragedy. Because all of a sudden, you're sharing your opportunities with others. So all of those lines were ways to get people to respond emotionally. Intellectually, is the wall going to be built? And more than that, is Mexico going to pay for it? Really? Even if you supported him and want the wall, do you believe that? I don't think so. Lock her up? It's never happened before. He claimed he was going to investigate after the fact, but it's never happened in American politics. It probably won't happen again. It's aspirational. It worked. Good, bad, that's for other people to decide, or I say so privately, but not publicly. But from a messaging point of view, Trump created messages that were all about them. Coincidentally, the title of my book.
Oh, coincidentally, that's right. Yeah, Maria, but what were about those messages that resonated with the Hispanic community? The Hispanic community, 30% went for Trump nationwide. Again, 40-some-odd percent of the Cuban vote went for Trump. Those messages resonated well beyond what a lot of pollsters have seen as kind of that white working class vote. It appealed across racial classes, across gender classes even.
I am still pondering about why it is that it resonated so loudly with a lot of the groups that you would have thought as an outsider, you know, would have felt marginalized. I think Cuban Americans have a very privileged position because of our benefits in the country. And so I think that
the favored immigration status that
right,
you're able to enjoy. Right.
When we talk about the response of Latinos and then Cuban Americans, it's really two different groups with two separate sets of interest. So for Cuban Americans who don't really have, you know, family in Cuba, for example, which is such a big incentive to maintain relations with Cuba, because a lot of us go back so frequently, we want to, for example, just maintain, a policy of engagement. But there's another generation that feels like, more liberal discourse sounds like communist discourse for some reason, and because they still, you know, and for very strong reasons, they feel still so attached to the origin of their migration here in the first place, I think that anything that sounds like wealth redistribution or have and have nots, where they could fall in the have nots, is dangerous.
Along those lines, for first generation, second generation folks, education is a big part of that, achieving the American dream, going after the American dream. What does this election do on the student loan, on the affordability issue? That was a big piece of Senator Sanders' campaign and a big source of support for him during the primary. You didn't see a lot of that, didn't hear much of that necessarily from a Trump campaign.
His focus on deportation of illegal immigrants has certainly caused a lot of anxiety, especially among undocumented students. And we're still seeing universities, you know, sort of formulating the appropriate responses to a lot of the demands from students that we've seen in the last few weeks. Students are coming together on campus with the support of faculty and staff and demanding that universities become a place of, you know, as they come, they become sanctuary campuses for them, even though we still don't know exactly what that means, and the kinds of supports that are being requested from different universities vary. But we'll still need to see exactly what the position of these students will be coming along. I can foresee definitely that enrollment numbers might be down, and students might be, and parents in general, they might be more afraid of making any decisions that would reveal their status in the country. I do want to mention that a lot of these undocumented students, families, they should become more aware of policies that universities have to benefit students who are admitted regardless of their status, to grant them, for example, need-based financial aid. There are many universities that don't discriminate even you know, against students who don't have DACA protection, and these students are able to
against childhood arrivals.
Exactly, these students are able to enroll, to receive financial aid, to even work on campus and graduate.
Craig Pittman, I just want to finally get your thoughts here. You, in your book, quote a Fortune magazine writer saying, "Florida is a study in abnormal psychology." That was in 1948.
Right.
Here we are in 2016.
Yes.
Still a study in abnormal psychology.
Yes. And, there's a great line in Tim Dorsey's most recent novel, Coconut Cowboy, where he says, "Florida is the nation's pace car of dysfunction," which I, as a line I wish I had written.
What's the psychology then here as we move into 2017?
Yes. I think Florida will continue being Florida. I mean, we've got 20 million people living here now. We're the third most populous state, and more people coming every day. We've got about 100 million visitors coming to visit
every year.
And people aren't spread evenly across the peninsula. We're kind of crammed into that 20-mile-wide swath or along the coast or along I-4. So I think as we add more people, we'll continue to crash into each other's cars, chase each other around with machetes, and argue over whose dog pooped on whose lawn.
And if so, we'll read about it, certainly.
Yes,
with Craig
absolutely.
Pittman and Dave Barry Early. Craig Pittman is the author of Oh, Florida. Maria Carla Chiquin is Achieve the College Dream is her book, and Bruce Turkel, all about them. All, thank you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup here
thank
today.
You.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Live
thank
from
you.
The Miami Book Fair. Finally on the Roundup, a story in just six words. We asked South Florida to write a story about this place in just six words. Hundreds, thousands did, and we invited a few to join us here live at the Book Fair. Kenneth Wright is first up. Mr. Wright, welcome. What's your six-word story for us today?
My six-word story is Visit Miami. Only we have Zika.
What inspired that, Kenneth, other than just the small mosquito?
Yeah, well, I think that South Florida does a really good job of promoting itself with its beaches and its sun and all that kind of stuff. And I think that we've sorely unrepresented what's going on with Zika, both at the governmental and local level. So I have friends that come down here and visit, and they really don't know that. I had a friend come and say, well, you know, it's only downtown. I said, well, you know what? A mosquito can get in a car, travel quite far.
If that's the case, it'll experience the Miami traffic that has frustrated the rest of us in that case. Kenneth, we thank you very much for your six-word story. Rosemary DeMore is also here with us. Rosemary, welcome. What's your six-word story?
4 a.m., when runners meet nightclubbers.
Where was this story conceived?
So I'm a transplant to Miami. I moved here from Washington, D.C., and I moved to South Beach. And I was trying to survey the land a little bit and figure out kind of the culture down here. And yeah. I noticed there's really two very different communities. There's the clubbers who, you know, go out every night. And then there's the very healthy people who run at 4 a.m. because it gets too hot.
So which were you?
I'm unfortunately neither.
Neither. Okay. just a knowledgeable observer.
I noticed the only time that these two communities ever seem to meet is about 4 a.m. when the runners are out running early in the morning and the clubbers are just leaving.
Rosemary, thank you for sharing your story with us. Maria Bishop also has written a six-word Miami story she wants to share. Maria, welcome.
Thank you. So my story is in Spanish. Arroz con mango, gringo con cubana. I've been in Miami most of my life. I'm Cuban, and my husband is from the United States, fifth generation Californian. the idea of white rice and mango mixing together is kind of a metaphor for our marriage. But apart from that, in Spanish, in many countries, un arroz con mango is kind of a complication. It's a big mess. It's sort of become, oh my gosh, you know, it's a mess. So, you know, Cuban-American, multicultural, Latin, North yeah. American marriage, arroz con mango.
There you go. Food is a metaphor for love and life in South Florida. Roxana Eldon, we'll have you bring up the final six-word story for us. Welcome.
My story is, at the obstetrician, everyone's wearing heels.
And did you?
I did not. I was the only one. I'm actually a Chicago transplant.
Wonderful. And we should point out you're wearing flats.